Professor Igor Lukács teaches at Boston University and has written extensively on modern Czech history, the Cold War, and contemporary developments in Central and Eastern Europe. When we spoke recently, the conversation took in everything from his increasingly sympathetic view of Neville Chamberlain to his own arrival in New York in the late 1970s. But I first ask the renowned historian about his early life in communist Czechoslovakia.
I was born in Letná, in Prague, the day the Korean War broke out on June 25th, 1950. The first memory I have is, I was just reflecting on it this morning, of the day Stalin died. It's 1953. It's only a fleeting trace. And then the next one is the death of Zapotocký. I must have been six or something like that, a little older. So I grew up in the city, and I didn't have any particular sort of grand vision of the world. And it was really only in 1968 that one became a political animal. I was in Britain until 20th of August 1968. I returned in the afternoon, and a few hours later somebody called that the Russians were taking over, which in a way was nonsense because the Russians had taken over in 1945, but somehow we didn't know, you know, we were able to miss that. But certainly I walked out, it was probably 2-3 in the morning with a friend. I saw a dead person, and I thought my childhood was over. It's a kind of, it's not that anybody shot at me. I wasn't at all heroic. I wasn't one of those really incredibly brave 16-year-old kids, mostly working class, who would jump on Russian tanks and set it afire with just matches and a crowbar. I was an observer at best, but just seeing the kind of violence and so on made it very clear that, one was no longer a child.
Many of the subjects that you later wrote about, for example, Munich, Beneš, the Slansky trial, they're related to the decades just before you were born or to your very early years. Was there a lot of talk in your home, in your household, about these subjects?
Well, yes, certainly there probably wasn't a Czech household that wouldn't have discussed Munich in some form or fashion. So absolutely yes about Munich. Whether we understood it, I don't know. In fact, my own views of Munich have been changing, evolving quite a lot. I'm now much more sympathetic to Chamberlain than I used to be. But Slansky and so on, that obviously is an entirely different can of worms. My grandmother was in prison as an alleged American spy, which she definitely was not. She was just a very simple woman who let somebody stay overnight, maybe once or twice, and for that she received a very serious prison penalty. And I spent a lot of time with her, and I think she shared with me many stories about her prison time, in part because she needed to talk to someone, and in part because she thought that I was just too little and too dumb to remember. So she wasn't running any risks in confessing to me.
But you were soaking it all up?
And I was soaking it up just beyond any imagination. Exactly. And I think she probably didn't tell her own daughter what she had experienced in prison because she probably considered it too dangerous and so on. So, but she was willing to talk to me. So I think I had a fairly solid education in that sense.
You said you have become more sympathetic towards Chamberlain. Why is that?
As I get older, I obviously understand the limitations that exist in the real world on one's freedom of action. When I was much younger, I considered him simply a coward and most likely a vacuous person. And now I think of him more as somebody who was sort of seriously horrified by the prospect of another war. Britain had experienced one 2 decades before. And there was every reason, you know, not to leave a stone unturned in searching for ways of avoiding a repetition of that madness in which generations were lost. So when he finally traveled to Munich and smiled at Hitler and shook his hand. Obviously, it was wrong, in part because it didn't work, right? But was the attempt to avoid war in itself immoral? I'm no longer so certain as I would have been when I was younger.
You have described life in communist Czechoslovakia as a velvet prison. Could you explain that idea?
I went through high school without any sort of awareness of the limitations that the communists had imposed upon our intellectual horizons. I could go to any movie theater and see Bergman or Fellini or, any good American movie. I probably had seen it. When I finally arrived in New York at the end of the 70s, I think many Americans, because I spoke relatively good English, I think they probably took me simply as one who somehow belonged, because I completely understood references to Midnight Cowboy or something like this, you know. Or I knew all the sort of pop music and so on. So I think it was relatively easy to live in communism and yet to partake in the riches of Western culture, certainly in the Czech communism, so in the 60s especially, right? But even in the 70s, although it was horrific to watch the sort of normalization and the moral compromises that people started making, that was obviously deeply, deeply depressing. But it was still possible to sort of live in this sort of illusion that you were free because you could read Western novels, you could see Western movies, and even Westerners could come and visit you, which they often did.
I think even for somebody from Western Europe, moving to the States in the 70s would have been a culture shock. What did you find, coming from Eastern Europe, what did you find the hardest to adjust to in America?
See, this is a question that I obviously had been posing to myself many, many times, many years ago, and I have an answer. The only thing that shocked me about America at the end of the 70s was how normal it was. I wasn't prepared for it. I was prepared for truly insane society, you know. I already mentioned Midnight Cowboy, and I imagined that I would end up sleeping under the bridges of New York, and that it would be raining, and I would eat biscuits from some cafe mixed with ketchup or something like this. And yet it turned out that, in fact, Americans were completely normal. When my mother visited me for the first time in America sometime in the 1980s, she noted that the Americans she met reminded her of the Czechs she had known during the so-called First Republic, that is, during the interwar period.
What was the similarity?
Well, that they were somehow normal, you know. Nazism and communism twisted people's characters, and people never established eye contact, for instance. You know, they never looked you in the eye.
They still don't.
They still don't, that's right. This is true. This is quite true. Exactly. My wife often notes that, you know, when we had these two beautiful daughters and we would come to some store with these two angels, the salesperson would, you know, look and frown, whereas every other mammal on this planet would say, oh, what a beautiful girl. You're quite right. So I think what she simply meant was that people's characters had not been twisted. You know, that's really the best I can tell you.
You've written quite a lot about the Cold War. I wanted to ask you, as a historian, do you think the Cold War has been returning in recent years, or did it never really end in the first place?
I certainly don't think the Cold War has come back. I am not a great believer in that. I think that the Cold War was premised on the existence of the Soviet Union, which was not just a state. It was not just a superpower with nuclear missiles. It was also a state based on an ideological assumption that a long-term coexistence between the world of communism and the world of so-called capitalism — I don't believe that capitalism exists either, but that's a different issue — that such coexistence was possible, and that sooner or later one or the other would have to give. And that is, I think, what caused the Cold War to be a Cold War, that the West really, at some point, started taking seriously the threat that the other side wanted to, as Khrushchev put it, will bury you, right? Whereas I think Russia, for all its dangerous moves since Putin came to power, does not have this ideological drive, this ideological engine. And so I think, therefore, we are in a completely different environment from the one that governed international relations until the end of the 1980s.
You're obviously based in the US. You have observed the rise of Trump at relatively close quarters. Can he usefully be compared to any historical figure? Some people have drawn at least vague parallels between him and Hitler.
I think we all should be very hesitant to compare anybody to Hitler. I think many people would, in fact, say that Hitler has a unique position in the scale of grand evil. So I definitely would not have compared him with Hitler. But I think there are certainly similarities with Mussolini. On the other hand, Mussolini was an intellectual. I hope I'm not offending anybody, but and in his youth, Mussolini was a student of theology, for instance. He wrote a relatively decent book about Jan Hus, a hero of Prague. And I can assure you that Mr. Trump has never heard of Jan Hus. I think that even here, the parallel is not very accurate, because I think Trump is an ignoramus. I think Trump is a TV personality. I think he is a failed businessman. I think he is a man who brilliantly creates illusions. He is a master of deception. But I don't think there is much substance to him.
I'd like to end on a kind of personal question. I've heard you speaking in the past about the problem of exile, that you never really feel at home in either place. But given that you've been coming forward and back between here and the States for so many years now, does exile get easier as you get older or over the years?
It really gets harder. In fact, exile was very easy during the Cold War. The moment I and my friends landed in New York, we knew exactly who we were. We had nothing to do with Hussack's Czechoslovakia and its pseudo-values, and we totally embraced New York and the United States of America, and we became very proud American citizens. But once the Cold War ended and Havel became president, it became much more complicated. And now that that Havel guy, yes, exactly. And now, of course, there is the Trump guy, and it gets harder and harder to decide where one belongs. And every time I come here, I spend several days being angry at those Czechs who fail to establish eye contact and who seem so rude and who wear these funny clothes that they buy at some, I don't know where they buy them, with those pseudo-English signs on the T-shirts and so on. And it takes me some time to get used to it. But once I leave, I'm already plotting how to get back. So in that sense, I think exile gets harder and harder.